Charm of Favor, the foreword.
New content has been added to this edition, which will make the audio chapters line up with the second edition of Charm of Favor.
Less than 61 years after the original 1787 Constitutional Convention, Washington, D.C. was already well on its way to becoming the central control power the Founding Fathers feared. Politicians arguing and positioning over access to power and to the Treasury debated to prevent any one man from acquiring a throne like that of Mother England. Far from it. It was designed to act like a republic, where everyone in the country had representation in the halls of government that served the people and did not rule over them. The original 13 states had already grown to 30, with the addition of Wisconsin on May 28th of 1848. Just days before, on May 22nd, the Democratic National Committee was formed, and almost immediately began asserting itself to seizing control of the government. Previously known as the Anti-Federalists, the Democrats highly favored a country run solely by the president. Formerly known as the Whigs, the Republicans thought the nation would best adhere to the Constitution by letting Congress take the lead. Within 24 months, however, elected officials began abusing their power, as they supposed, to levy the Tariff of Abominations against the southern states. It was crafted to extract money from the South's agrarian prosperity and foreign trade to subsidize their industrial political supporters in the North. The Democrats' lust for power left those states, most of which were slave-owning Democrats, no choice but to secede from the Union by listing the same grievances against the federal government as the original 13 colonies had filed against King George. After all, the Union was new, and it was not working for every state equally. After countless impassioned pleas on the floor of Congress for more than 10 years, 13 southern states, led by South Carolina, began filing declarations of causes as reasons to secede from the Union. The result of the filing of those 1861 grievances was exactly the same as the colony's 1774 submission, except that the 13 states could not withstand the military-industrial supply chain of the North, coupled with their scorched-earth battle tactics. The southern states were forced back into the Union through unconditional surrender and by signing a writ of reconstruction. Only Texas refused to sign as they re-entered the Union. Still, it was a Republican President Lincoln who tried his best to bring the nation back together, but his lack of diplomacy led the country into the bloodiest war in U.S. history, costing 750,000 Americans their lives and injuring at least that many more. History does not widely report that Lincoln acquired many enemies, which included a central banking cartel determined by any means necessary to gain control over this new nation's money supply. He also had not pleased the Democrat powers of the North, which drew it into the southern states, from whom they were leeching the capital required to expand their profits. His real opponent was never the states of the South, but rather a cadre of secret powers operating inside the American government who would never allow a Republican president to take credit or control of what could already arguably be considered the greatest economic potential the world had ever known. So they conspired to have him assassinated. Then, as now, the ones responsible for unspeakable crimes and espionage were never brought to justice. Almost as soon as Lincoln stopped breathing, the United States signed the Rothschild Central Bank Charter. The history of men is not like the concentric rings in a tree stump. It is not an academic or predictable record like the decay of a nuclide or even a geometric proof. Most people would agree it is not even a legitimate attempt at the truth, but rather it is crafted and polished by the victors. In some cases, it was scraped together out of ashes by the survivors, scattered and forgotten victims of wars so terrible and brutal that the officers lost their minds in endless nightmares or took their own lives to stop the pain. In still other cases, there was a concerted and presumably successful effort to fabricate the past so that a future of choice could be charted. Once the ships of time sailed from the shores of that past, the frothy trail left in the sea of potentialities was the only truth men would know from that time forward, if time does indeed only go forward. But when humans begin to reconstruct things upon which future generations would reflect, like assembling the pieces of a crashed passenger airliner, the reconstruction begins to tell a different story. The true purpose of history cannot be withheld from the universe. It can be forgotten by men. It can be corrupted. It can even be denied. But the truth can never be erased from the universe. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, and the effects cannot exist without first there must be a cause. Just as a rounded pebble is proof there was once a moving body of water that made it, there are spots of blood, or threads of uniforms, or documents, or bullets, or screams laying in the soil that record what really happened. There is always fear in the dust of history. There is the fear that the victims will remain nameless. There is a fear that justice lies docile beneath a beautifully manicured lawn. For some, it is a fear that justice will never be served, and for others, it is that it will. When evil makes its grand and terrible designs, the planning can take centuries. The roots that feed the design must remain obscured, so that in war and peace, they can nourish the organism that will choke off the light from everything else around it. Crime syndicates are like twisted, hard, and merciless dark wood, so relentless and strong that they can break apart solid stone. A member of that syndicate would no more betray it than a root or a leaf would betray the tree organism it serves. The early churches were excoriated by Jesus for placing all their value upon their genealogy. It was vital to be a child of Abraham. And if you could actually recite your lineage all the way to Adam, it provided you a rite of passage, an unmitigated authority over the tribe, as it were. The denial of a birthright throughout the scriptures has been the cause of every evil uprising. Cain and Abel, Esau and Jacob, Laman and Lemuel, Lucifer and Adam all tell the same story. To evil, the birthright is paramount. To righteousness, the purity of the soul's intent attracts the blessing of inheritance. Perhaps nowhere is it expressed more clearly than in the book of Luke. Jesus said, "Bring forth therefore fruits worthy of repentance, and begin not to say within yourselves, We have Abraham to our father. For I say unto you that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham." Crime syndicates gain their power through their inheritance. The name and the lineage is the key to all power. It is a type and a shadow of how powers function on earth. A man without a family heritage is an outsider, and may win an election from time to time. But they will never be handed the keys of power, because those keys are held by principalities that adhere to these ancient ways of magic and darkness. Just such a genealogical pathway was crafted where none existed in 1945, while William Jefferson Blythe Jr. was U.S. Army active duty serving in Italy. He is listed by most accounts of history to be the biological father of William Jefferson Blythe Clinton, the 42nd President of the United States. The biological problem with this claim to lineage is that Virginia Del Kelly Cassidy, Bill Clinton's mother, was already 3 months pregnant with him when Blythe returned from Italy. Reports that Virginia gave birth at 6 months of pregnancy due to a fall turned out to be false when Vanity Fair tracked down the midwife who delivered her baby boy. She reported that he was, in fact, delivered as a full-term baby, weighing between 8 and 9 pounds on August 19, 1946. Further investigation showed that not only was he the bastard child of Virginia Kelly's affair with an unknown man from Louisiana, but that her marriage to Blythe was fabricated by friends of the family as he lay in the morgue dead. What vision was beheld that caused such a plan to be set in motion cannot be written or told by any man alive. But the Kelly family reportedly created a new name for Tyrell, the true birth name of Virginia's baby boy, and a new lineage for whom history would record as William Jefferson Blythe, carefully leading back to Andrew Jackson Blythe, a name with a lengthy history from the original 13 colonies of America. She later married Roger M. Clinton Sr., and he adopted Bill, giving him the family name by which he would be known. It was the perfect pedigree for a boy destined by powers beyond this world to be president. Only now, at the end, is betrayal appropriate, for the soul of a human is required as payment in exchange for the charm of favor that delivered the fame and power and wealth of this world in a single mortal lifetime. To such a man must be provided a mate, a queen, as it were, for the glory of world leadership rarely falls to less than a pair. Occasionally a queen shall reign in a figurative sort of way, but kings must have a queen in order to shoulder the true mantle of power. The charm requires a female energy to complete the circle of power. Something in the formation of Fibonacci rotations must be symmetrical and complementary, so that tiny movements made at the right time in the right amount can resonate to great unstoppable momentum with very little energy input. This female energy must have a source that matches the male energy in frequency, meaning that it cannot be too dark or too light. It cannot be too red or too blue. Like the backside of a coin, it has the same value and the same weight of gold. In the face of the coin is a good man. Then the female side of the coin must be a good woman. If the face on the coin is that of an evil tyrant, then nothing less than a sorceress will do for the backside. Such was the case in a young lawyer named Hillary Rodham. She displayed no desire to represent clients for the cause of justice. She was born on October 26, 1947, in Chicago to Hugh and Dorothy Rodham, and raised in Park Ridge, Illinois, along with her younger brothers, Hugh Jr. and Anthony. At the tender young age of 27, she had already proven herself worthy of the task. Her skills would best serve those who wished to escape justice or to prosecute the innocent, depending upon the situation. While teaching at the University of Arkansas School of Law in 1975, Hillary Rodham was allegedly selected by Judge Maupin Cummings to defend Thomas Alfred Taylor, who had been accused of raping a 12-year-old girl. Cummings picked Clinton's name from a list he kept of attorneys who would represent poor clients, and this poor client specifically requested a female attorney. While she knew her client was guilty, she pursued his victim with zeal by accusing her of secretly fantasizing about having sex with older men. She even meticulously manipulated the evidence so that Taylor would serve only a year for a lower charge of improperly fondling a minor. She stated publicly, "But you know, what was sad about it is that the prosecutors had the evidence, among which was his underwear, which was bloody, sent it down to the crime lab. The crime lab took the pair of underpants, neatly cut out the part that they were going to test, tested it, came back with the result of what was kind of blood it was, what was mixed with it, then sent the pants back with the hole in it to evidence. Of course, the crime lab had thrown away the piece that they had cut out. She simply sent the pants away again for testing, with its evidentiary portion removed. The new results came back inconclusive, and Taylor was a free man. Hillary would later openly laugh about her easy victory in court. To this day, she has never apologized for diverting justice in that case." She was so naturally corrupt that she was recommended to serve on the Watergate prosecution team by Burke Marshall, who was also Senator Ted Kennedy's chief counsel in the Chappaquiddick trial, where his young pregnant date drowned in his car that had been driven into a creek. When the Watergate investigation was over, her boss, Jerry Zeifman, fired her from the committee staff and refused to give her a letter of recommendation. It would only be one of three times he did so in his 17-year career. Instead, he stated publicly, she was a liar. She was an unethical, dishonest lawyer. She conspired to violate the Constitution, the rules of the House, the rules of the committee, and the rules of confidentiality. Bill and Hillary married on October 11, 1975, in the living room of their new home in Fayetteville, Arkansas. People would say the longevity of their marriage was due to a string of symbols and numbers that runs the universe, and yet is inaccessible to those who live in it. There have hardly been more than a few months go by that have not been embroiled in scandal, murder, suicide, graft, or subterfuge. Hillary Clinton gained notoriety early in their marriage by being the first lady in American history to be called to testify in front of a grand jury. Not only was Hillary called to testify, but as part of the grand jury investigation, she became the subject of accusations and suspicious activity concerning missing subpoenaed records from the Rose Law Firm, where she had worked in the mid-1980s. Of interest to prosecutors were Rose Law Firm records from the Whitewater land deal in Arkansas and Hillary's legal representation of convicted felon Jim McDougal Savings and Loan Association, Madison Guaranty. The Rose Law Firm records involved a particular phone call and transaction involving Hillary that was intended to deceive financial regulators, according to a Frontline series by the Public Broadcasting Service. Federal bank regulators went so far as to call the financial deal involving Hillary and the Rose Law Firm a sham. Even the history that was allowed to surface was beyond belief for the average person. Federal prosecutors subpoenaed documents surrounding the real estate transaction, but the papers mysteriously disappeared for 2 years, until January 1996, when Hillary's aide reported that they had magically appeared in the book room on the third floor of the White House in the Clintons' personal residence. How did they move from a small law firm in Arkansas to the personal residence in Washington, D.C.? Hillary was silent, a tactic that would serve them both well, as the forces of evil seemed to work like magic and making even the most serious charges grow stale and cold. The FBI was brought in by the Justice Department, and fingerprint analysis showed that there were only two sets of prints on those records. The prints were identified to be those of White House Deputy Legal Counsel Vince Foster and Hillary Clinton. Hillary, of course, stated she had no idea how the documents had ended up there. Vince Foster was found shot twice. On July 20th, 1993, once with a small caliber weapon in the neck and once with a 38 caliber weapon in the back of the head, and dumped cold and bloodless in the Fort Marcy Park on a gentle slope by a Civil War cannon. The photos taken of the body at the scene were copied on a Xerox machine and then faxed to Special Counsel Robert B. Fisk, Jr., who finally concluded from the grainy black-and-white images that Foster's death was a suicide, brought on by depression from the burdens he was carrying for the Clintons. 22 years later, the clear Park Police color photos of Vince Foster's body would be found, well-preserved, in a basement, along with a box of evidence from the investigation that would bring Fisk's conclusion of suicide into question. How could a man kill himself with two different caliber guns fired into his own head and neck from two different entry angles, both of which were impossible to self-inflict? The Senate Whitewater Committee, which at the time also was investigating the matter, ultimately concluded the Rose Law Firm billing documents indeed had been placed into the White House book room in the private residence area by Hillary Clinton herself. A hard drive had been removed from Foster's White House computer and mysteriously went missing within minutes of his body being found by Park Police. It eventually turned up in the old executive office building across the street from the White House, but investigators ultimately were unable to recover anything from the hard drive because it had been significantly and purposefully damaged. Once again, the charm of favor made the questions disappear like dried leaves blown into a pile of other dried leaves, never to be considered again by anyone. This book is fiction, or as close as the author could get to it, considering the true story in every chapter. It was not written to entertain, or even to fascinate. It was written to awaken the reader to a possibility that this is much more than two criminal minds plotting to have a wonderful life of politics and parties and immeasurable wealth. It is the story of a crime syndicate that connected men and money from around the world through a trillion-dollar web of corruption and power. Even the most aggressive conspiracy theories only involve a few hundred dead bodies, a few $1 billion, and a few women and children raped, more or less. This book is real history, as seen through the eyes of my fictional characters, going to open your eyes to an insidious crime syndicate so powerful and so wealthy that it has destroyed millions of innocent people of all ages and races. It has become associated with the largest producer and distributor of drugs the world has ever known. The assassinations, money laundering, weapons trafficking, and the sale or seizure of national treasures for personal benefit is all true. This crime syndicate has ordered up wars on demand, purchased every major media outlet in the Western world, and runs one of the most relentless and powerful political organizations in history. It has active and loyal agents inside every agency, department, bureau, and administration in American government, and they use their power to write and enforce law to protect the syndicate from loss or harm, and will stop at nothing to defeat its enemies. The Clinton Crime Syndicate is active and operating at the time this book is published, perhaps even as you are reading it.